Oh, you're muted.
Okay, I did unmute, so I don't know why it went back again, but anyway. So once again, welcome everyone, and this is our last one for a while. Next week I'm not here, and then we've got the Easter break, and I'm not too sure when we will be picking things up again. But today we're reaching the end of our rather rapid survey through Mark's Gospel, looking at chapter 14, 15, and 16. But I also want to diverge away a little bit in terms of the themes that it contains, and look at a bit more generally, I suppose, across other gospels. But we'll start with chapter 14. We'll break it down into sections. So it's the first 11 verses to start with, which I'll give you just a minute or so to read through. But just to give you a little bit of background to this, this is one of these passages where it's got a little bit of an introduction, two verses, and an end point, two more verses, and then the main bit in the middle. It's a bit of a sandwich. So when you read it, you've got the first two verses, then 3 to 9, and then 10 and 11 to sort of round it off again. So have a look at the first 11 verses of Mark chapter 14, and as usual, have any comments ready for when we pick it up. But it'll only take you a minute to read that little bit. Okay, let's start to look through these few verses. And so we've got to start with the scheme to kill Jesus, the beginning of the plot, but not during the festival. And at the end of it, you've got the fact that the plot is now underway because Judas Iscariot has agreed to take part. And in between, you've got this incident away from Jerusalem. So this is in one of the evenings, probably the last evening that he's going to spend away with friends. And something happens here, which we're going to find many times in these few passages in this chapter and so on, that things don't go well for some of Jesus' followers, that they sort of get things a bit wrong at times. So it mentions the Passover and the Festival of Unleavened Bread, which just reminds you was basically a way of saying the same thing, because they ran straight on together, Passover and unleavened bread following straight on. Passover, then 7 more days of unleavened bread. Then that sometimes, if it says the Passover festival or the Feast of Unleavened Bread, it can include both of them as a single time. So what do you make of this incident in Bethany then? Any thoughts on the main part of this little passage, this particular event? What will your comments be, Malcolm?
Well, verse 2, before we get to read down yet,
Yeah, okay.
they said, not during the festival, or the people will riot. Well, that tells a lot about the way they were thinking, doesn't it?
Yeah,
They
yeah, it
reckon
does, and it
that
explains a lot of the things, yeah, to come. And why they were pleased that Judas said he would find a way around that for them. And why eventually it worked out the way it did. So, yeah, thanks for that next point. First thing I found interesting, this is in the house of a leper, reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper. Well, actually, I don't suppose he was really, because you wouldn't go to the home of a leper. So this must be Simon the former leper, who seems, it must have been healed, in other words, but unfortunately, he seems still to be known as Simon the leper. Malcolm again.
In verse 3, my just complete Jewish Bible says, a man who had had Tzara'at.
Yeah,
See.
which I think must be the case, because you wouldn't go around there for a meal if you'd still got it. So, but I say it's just unfortunate that he's still labelled as that particular thing. Now you get this extravagant act with the jar and the perfume. I mean, she doesn't just pour all the perfume, she actually breaks the jar as well. I don't know how expensive an alabaster jar is. The perfume obviously was very, very expensive. You might have anointed a guest, a special guest, with a little drop or two, but not the whole lot. And therefore, she comes in for criticism by, well, some of them present, it doesn't say exactly who. But one of them could well have been, almost certainly would have been, I think, Judas. I don't know if that's in another gospel, but I seem to remember that he sort of doesn't like this sort of thing. John?
I thought you had to break it to get it out.
Oh, I see. So you don't think
alabaster jars are, they must, I don't know how they work, because I've never seen an alabaster jar, although in Yemen they had a lot of alabaster windows. But in Yemen, I was told, you put the stuff in the jar and the only way to get it out is to break the jar.
So you mean break the whole jar, not just sort of break the top, break the seal?
Well, break the top off, but you can't put the top back on. You've got to use the lot when it's...
Right. Okay, that presumably makes sense then. So you didn't sort of just smash the whole jar, broke it open, basically. Thank you. Okay. If it could have been sold for more than a year's wages, then it really would have been expensive. I mean, that's a way of saying it's a lot of money. So she gets told off by all the others, except for Jesus, of course, because he calls it a beautiful thing and refers it to his own burial. So he's understood what she's been doing. Is that John and Rose again, or is that still the same hand?
No, it's a new hand. Yeah. I've always wondered why nobody questioned him when he said, this has been done for my burial.
You mean that's quite a statement, and so why is there no response to that?
Why is nobody saying what burial? You know, you're kind of warm and breathing.
Yeah, because of course you wouldn't do it several years in advance, would you? So it would cause a bit of a kerfuffle. Having said that, of course, I don't know when she poured it all over him. Well, she poured it on his head, so you can assume it's going to drip down. Of course, we don't know how big the jar was either, do we? So there's lots of unknowns here, perhaps. Because by the time Jesus was buried, then this would have already sort of had its effect and so on. We've got Alison next.
Yes, one of the things I find, particularly in Mark's gospel, is that the way that the sayings are put, the sayings of Jesus are written, kind of jars a little bit in a way, because they're very cryptic and brief.
Okay.
One kind of assumes that the people he was with would have understood that he needed to be honoured.
Yeah.
Because if one of us sort of said what he said, it would be outrageous, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But he must have kind of, with that particular group of people, have earned that right. I mean, we know the disciples already had acknowledged him as the anointed one.
Yes.
But I don't know if it's just me, but I just, it's very difficult. I find Mark's gospel particularly, but also some of the others, quite difficult just to read.
Yeah, because of the sort of brevity and the lack of detail that you would like.
Yeah.
I mean, when it says a woman came, you don't know whether she was one of the invited guests or whether she just sort of burst in and did this without being
popular. Well, people did burst in, didn't they? When people were invited to dinner, if it was anybody who was vaguely important or whatever, they had their invited guests, and then other people could sort of mill around the edge. They didn't kind of get the food, but they could listen in on the conversation.
Bit of an open house.
If there was somebody invited who was kind of worth listening to, then people would kind of wander through.
Yeah, so this was a bit of a sort of unexpected thing that happened then, yeah. John or Jan?
My notes in the NIV say that we know from John's gospel it was Mary, Martha's sister.
Right.
And the sealed flask with a long neck was broken off when the contents were used, and it contained enough ointment for one application.
Okay.
The nard was made from aromatic oil extracted from the root of a plant grown chiefly in India.
Wow. So it would be expensive if it came all the way from there. Okay. But yeah, so it's a small flask, and although it would cover the whole head, but it wasn't like, you know, the big jars we might have thought of. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's very useful. The main point of it all at the end is that Jesus says, wherever the gospel is preached, what she has done will be told in memory of her. So there we are. We've just told it in memory of her whoever she was, Jesus was right there. That it got in the gospel, in other words. In fact, I suppose afterwards they couldn't possibly leave it out the gospel, having Jesus having said that. So, so the next point is the Last Supper, which I think you're probably fairly familiar with, but you can skim through this as we go from verses 12 to 26.
Sorry, can I just add in?
Of course.
Again, my notes, verse 8, to prepare for burial, it was normal Jewish custom to anoint a body with aromatic oils in preparing for burial. But Jesus seemed to anticipate suffering a criminal's death, for only in that circumstance was there no anointing of the body.
Okay, yeah. But, of course, the other point, which we said, why was there no further comment? Presumably you only did it once the person was dead and Jesus wasn't yet dead. So what she did was extraordinary and worthy of extra comment because she did it then. Right. But, yeah, that's a good point about the type of death and burial and so on, criminal's death. So this so-called Last Supper, well, it was last, and I suppose it was a supper. There's some very strange sort of items about it, I guess. It's very well prepared. Got another jar this time, but it's a jar of water. What do you make of the fact that it's a man carrying a jar of water? That's in verse 13. The disciples, in order to go to the right place, have to find and follow a man carrying water. We've got two Johns. We take your pick, John first, John and Rose first.
So some folks say that it was being an Essene.
Yeah.
because they were men who would rather than a lady who would be carrying the water.
Yeah. So normally it's a woman's job, of course, naturally. But there's the Essenes were an all male community. So how does that fit? Does that lead to any further questions or comments? Let's suppose that was the case. What would you deduce from that? Anything? Because this was very well prepared, so they must have deduced something from it. Got someone just coming in. I'll let them in first.
Yeah, would that mean that the guest house where he went for the Last Supper was one of the Essene houses?
Yeah.
They had a guest house in Jerusalem.
Yes, they did. They had property in Jerusalem. We think they mainly were, in Qumran outside, but they did have rooms. It also suggests that Jesus is very familiar with them. You don't say, where's my guest room, and so on, if you don't really sort of know the group and the people. but the other thing about the Essenes, which you may have heard of, is that they celebrated Passover a day earlier than the main Orthodox Jewish calendar, because they were very sort of anti-Jerusalem anyway, and it's like, if they do it one way, we'll do it another. So why would that both make sense? If that was the case, and important, why would Jesus want to do this a day earlier than normal, if you like?
Well, so he could be sacrificed on the day that the lamb killed, but he'd already have celebrated. Yeah.
So he wouldn't be around 24 hours later when everybody else was doing it. And again, you have to piece this together across the various Gospels, but we know that when I mentioned this later in terms of the trial, that the Jewish leaders wouldn't go into Pilate's house because they didn't want to be unclean before eating the Passover. So they were going to eat it at the sort of normal time. But the other question then about this is that, was it really a Passover meal? It might have been a sort of equivalent or similar to it, but it doesn't fit the sort of Passover that you think about, because normally a Passover being a sort of celebration of coming out of Egypt in the Exodus was a whole family thing. There would be women, there would be children around the retelling of it. Obviously there'd be a lamb which would have been roasted and so on. None of those sort of details are here. It seems a slightly different sort of meal between Jesus and his friends, if you like. Although it's called a Passover, they prepared it as a Passover, and maybe that was part of it, but it wasn't the Orthodox one by the looks of it. Malcolm?
Well, it makes sense that he was observing the Essenes Passover a day early, because then he would have been 3 days and nights in the grave.
No, that depends upon the crucifixion being a day earlier. Which is, I take your point, and I wasn't going to go into all of that. Oh, what I was going to say, as I've done a series of Easter reflections, short talks on my website, and at the moment you'll find four of them are up, and there's two more to come by next week. And you will, on that one, you will see that I talk about this whole 3 day and three night thing in quite a bit of detail, because I'm not very happy with the way it's normally expressed. But
not being what we would expect it to be, if the Essenes were an all-male community, they wouldn't have any women and children to bring along.
No, but this is Jesus doing his own, I mean, probably the disciples didn't either, from that point of view. Right. Maybe he's, because he's doing it for in their place, that therefore he obviously does an all-male version himself. Yes, yeah, okay, fair enough. Yeah. John, and then Alison.
Just to comment that it has, in some circles, said that, of course, they didn't need a lamb to be roasted because Jesus was the lamb.
Well, yes, true. And the point is that he was going to use this time to initiate the new covenant with the bread and the cup, or the wine, whatever's in it. Mm-hmm. So whether they had a lamb as part of their meal or whether they didn't, because that wasn't really the full Passover that we're doing, we don't know. The most important bit about it was not so much to celebrate a past event, but to inaugurate the new one that's about to happen. So that's part of it. Mm-hmm. Alison?
I think the situation of the Essenes is a little bit more complicated, because in the Galilee, there certainly were Essenes who did have families.
Okay, yeah.
Certainly the community at Qumran, there were no women present.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a totally celibate
No, okay, I think I've heard something similar, that there were exceptions to that, yeah. But it's also the time when, of course, he announces that someone is going to betray him. Again, you might find, or might say, that Mark's account here is a bit brief compared to some others, and there's more details that we get elsewhere that would be useful to know about, because he actually identifies when everyone says, who is it? Is it me? And so on. But Jesus is basically saying, this is my last time for this. So we've had the anointing for his burial. We've had him announcing that I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine till I drink it new in the kingdom of God, if you make of that. But again, it's suggesting something's coming to an end, or there's something here happening. Jesus announces a betrayal. So, and then they sing a hymn. Whether it's ancient or modern, we don't know. But presumably they sung a psalm of some kind, and then left to go out to the Mount of Olives. Now, the next little bit seems to suggest, therefore, that they're already on that journey. But I think in other Gospels, when Jesus predicts Peter's denial, it's probably still sort of in the room and so on. It's not sort of out on the streets. But we get Peter's famous one statement, which everybody, all the other disciples, would have been absolutely thrilled with. Even if all the others fall away, I won't. Just imagine the looks he would have got at the end of all that. But he's put down immediately by Jesus by saying, that's not going to happen, is it? And Peter says the same thing, and then all the others chip in because they don't want to be left out of this. Oh, I'll never disown you, and so on. One of the things I mention in my talks on the Jewish Jesus, and that will be in the next book, is how significant and severe Peter's denial really is. You've got Judas, who is going to betray Jesus in the sense of take some money in order to identify who he is. But when eventually we get to Peter's denial or disownment, which is at the very end of chapter 14, and it doesn't, again, come across quite so strongly in Mark's gospel, I think it's more in sort of John's gospel, he is asked very specifically, aren't you one of his disciples? And Peter says, I am not. And that is more than just a bit of a denial. It's an actual complete betrayal of his rabbi, the person he has been with for 3 years, who has been training him, teaching him, and enabling him to become the man he is. At that point, he says, I am not his disciple. And that is a very severe betrayal of the relationship that they've had. So our English versions sometimes don't quite pull that out quite as strongly. And that's why when eventually, you know, the cock crows and Peter realizes exactly what's happened, he goes out and he weeps bitterly, because he's understood what he has just done. He's not just put his foot in it again, or, you know, been a bit sort of bad about what he said. He has actually destroyed everything that he's been building up for 3 years. He really thinks that's the end for him. It's all over from his point of view, in terms of discipleship. John or Jan?
Yeah, me this time. That's why after the resurrection, Jesus says, go tell my disciples and Peter.
Yeah.
Because Peter no longer classed himself as a disciple.
Yeah. And the others would probably think the same thing as well. So they would get that message. But don't forget, the story doesn't end there, because when they do meet up in Galilee, Jesus spends a little bit of time with Peter alone, restoring him, as we call it, on the beach there, with that breakfast, taking him to one side and bringing him back into the fold, if you like. And the significant thing about that is that once he's gone through the "Do you love me" three times, sort of undoing the denial three times, he then repeats to Peter what he'd said to Peter right at the very beginning, which is follow me, which is the call to discipleship. So he's being reinstated as a disciple right at the very end of John's gospel with the follow me. And that would mean Peter would realize that. And if we didn't have that restoration of Peter, if it was just left with the denial and everything sort of going wrong, the book of Acts wouldn't make a lot of sense, because you've got Peter back at the forefront, leading everybody else and preaching at Pentecost. How's that happened? You know, he's the worst disciple. He's not a disciple because of what he's done. But Jesus restored him back to what he promised. And in fact, you'll notice again in that last chapter of John, when Jesus is doing this, he calls him Simon Bar-Jonah. He goes back to his original name, Simon Bar-Jonah, until he has restored Peter. And then he's back to being Peter again, the rock, because he stopped being a rock for a little while. Anyway, more on that on my website. John?
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, it's also sealed with a meal, as it were. which, you know, they ate together. That's mean they were in fellowship together.
Yes.
So, they ate the meal before. Apparently before Jesus talked to Peter in particular, but it's part and parcel of the same
thing. I think so. And it makes you wonder whether Peter during that meal was thinking all the time, I'm not sure I belong here anymore. I'm the one that let them all down, and so on. But anyway, let's keep moving so that we... got Elizabeth next. Elizabeth?
I know it's fairly obvious, but... They passed the cup round and they all drank from the same cup.
That's in verse 23, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
That's quite significant, isn't it?
Yeah. Are you suggesting that when we do it in our church services with lots of little cups, then we're not quite doing it right? They perhaps didn't have COVID to worry about in those days.
Yeah, no, I just think it's, you know, because it's all part of his body, isn't it? He was making a statement, I think, wasn't he?
Of course. And it was a single piece of bread that was broken into bits and so on. And then I suppose he took a cup, meaning the cup that was in front of him. So he was giving them his own cup and so on. So, right. The next little bit is on Gethsemane. Again, I think we know that well enough to be able to comment on it without particularly reading from it. And there's another cup in this little section on Gethsemane, but of course this time it's not a real cup. It's the cup of sorrow, suffering, and so on, that Jesus says, take it from me, but not unless you really want that, Father. So he's going through the initial agony of what's going to happen, and he has to pray this through time and time again, and they keep falling asleep. Perhaps they'd had too much wine at the Passover meal, I don't know. And I suppose the other little detail is in verse 33, well, all the disciples seem to be there, but he takes Peter, James and John alongside a little bit to one side. He began to be deeply distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow. So already now he's going through the emotional agony of what's coming. John and Rose.
Yeah, the falling asleep thing, I think, is a spiritual battle process, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Jesus was, if you like, up to it, although he was obviously heavy duty in that spiritual battle, but the disciples and so on. I mean, how many times have folk come and they say, well, we're going to read sit down in your chair and read the Bible, and you're next thing you're nodding off, right? Or whatever else. It's the same kind of process going on, I think. That's how I would see it.
Yeah, indeed. And I've done the same thing in prayer meetings as well. So it's quite understandable. Plus, I suppose, I don't quite know what time we've got to, but we're heading perhaps towards bedtime for most of them. Don't know. Anyway, that's Gethsemane. And then, of course, he's arrested. Judas turns up with a crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Wow, I mean, a whole crowd? Really, why did they think they needed that many people? Well, that's why Jesus seems to be astonished in verse 48 when he realizes all these people have come out. He must have known something was about to happen. Judas was going to come back with some of them. But a huge, huge number. And then who have we got in verse 51, do you think? Verse 51 refers to a young man.
Mark, isn't it?
Yes, thank you. It's assumed to be, you can say that as well, John, Rose, yeah. It's assumed to be Mark himself, John Mark. What he was actually doing there, when he was following Jesus in some way, but he wasn't one of the 12. But at this point, he likes to bring himself into the story. And I wonder if he's sort of backing up Peter here, because when it came down to it, he ran away as well. It says that all the other disciples deserted him and fled. And Mark probably anonymously in some ways, but is associating with that and so on. Now, what I'm going to do, because now we've had the arrest and we're going into the trial, I'm going to go through the trial, not just from Mark, but from everywhere. So I'm transferring to another sort of set of notes on this so I get this right. I'm also just going to get some water. I'm feeling a bit tickly. Probably starting to go down with some of the things that other people have got. You don't get the whole trial in any one gospel. You have to sort of put it together from different bits and pieces. But the trial, if you've ever studied it yourself, you'll realise it's in several stages. And those stages have their own parts as well. So when you break it down, you're looking altogether at six different components to it. Two main parts, three stages to each. But it starts off in John chapter 11. So keep Mark in front if you like, but just to check this out, because John starts quite a bit earlier in chapter 11 and verse 47 to 53, where before the arrest actually happens, there is this plot, this meeting, this gathering of the Sanhedrin, where it is decided that this is what's going to happen. And this is when Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize it's better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. And he was sort of prophesying that Jesus would die because of that. But that's, if you like, before you get to the trial, the sort of background to it. The Sanhedrin had already met to set in motion a plot to kill Jesus. But of course, for this to happen, they needed the help of the Romans. But the Romans were not going to be too interested in executing what they might see of as a religious fanatic. Just disputes about religion and blasphemy and things like that were no concern to them. So that's why the trial has to be done in sort of two parts. The first bit was the religious trial. The second half was what we might call a civic trial, but basically Roman, if you like. And each bit is in three stages. So for the first stage of the religious trial, again, you see that kicks off in John chapter 18. And that's where they go to the high priest's house. So in John chapter 18, and it's from verse 12. So after the arrest, it says in John 18, 12, they bound him and brought him first to Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. And then it adds verse 14 of John 18. Caiaphas was the one who had already said that it'd be good if one man died, which would sort of calm the whole situation down and then we'd be able to get back to normal. So is a link back to the John 11 verse we looked at. So immediately after Jesus' arrest, he's taken to the high priest's house. And the idea is that he would be examined under Annas in order to establish the basis of a religious charge. In that, as it turns out, it was just ended up being a bit of a rough do. By the way, that's where you now get in John 18, what I mentioned before, where Peter's denial stroke betrayal was, you're one of these man's disciples, are you? I am not, was what Peter actually said. Malcolm, you got a comment?
Yeah, Mark doesn't mention here that the trial is illegal anyway because it's held after dark.
I talk about all the different bits that shouldn't have happened later because there's a lot of them, but yeah, okay. So he goes before Annas, first of all, and then you'll notice in verse, before we get to verse 24, that what actually happens in verse 19 onwards is the high priest starts to question him and so on, and one of the things that happens is that Jesus then gets slapped in the face as part of this sort of interrogation. That's another thing, of course, that shouldn't have happened. So, and then verse 24 says, Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Hang on, what's going on here? Hasn't he just been in front of Annas, the high priest, verse 19, and gone to the high priest's house? Why is he now being sent to Caiaphas, the high priest? Anyone can sort that little problem out. Who is high priest? Annas? Caiaphas? What's going on there? Any ideas?
Well, it's actually none of them should have been, should they?
Go on, because?
They were imposters from the time of the Maccabees. It was the wrong family.
Oh, okay. You're going back. Okay. Yeah, that's probably a good point. But even if they were both imposters, that doesn't explain why there was two imposters and not one. The point is that originally, of course, Annas was the high priest, but the Romans deposed him after 7 years and replaced him with his son-in-law, Caiaphas. So the official Roman version of the high priest was Caiaphas. But under Jewish law, once a high priest, always a high priest. So what the Romans had done wasn't allowed under their law. So the Jews continued to regard Annas as high priest, although they had to accept that the official title rested with Caiaphas. So that's the reason why there's two, whether they were neither of them proper ones and so on. So then he, Jesus, for the second part of the religious trial is before Caiaphas. And we can go back to Mark 14, if you like, although there's other verses, say, in Matthew on this. But we find that in Mark 14, verses 53 onwards. We're now picking up what Mark has said. So he's missed out the first bit, unless that's just a brief comment. It might be just verse 53 is a preliminary sort of thing. But anyway, then he goes before Caiaphas. And you find this in Matthew 26 as well, so it's not just in Mark. Caiaphas is now in charge. I mean, I guess it wasn't a big journey to go from one high priest to the other. They're probably in the same place. I don't quite know how their living arrangements worked and so on. But basically, Annas handed it over to Caiaphas. And at this point, they were looking for witnesses in order to back up the charge of blasphemy. And at this point, they tried to find people who could basically provide enough evidence for that particular charge. Malcolm?
In the Complete Jewish Bible, John 14, 53, interesting, it says, they led Yeshua to the Kohen Hagadol, which means the high priest, or the head Kohen priest, with whom all the head Kohanim, elders and Torah teachers, I mean, it's implying there that there's a more than two or three head Kohanim.
Well, I don't think the others were the high priest. I don't quite know what the phrase means. The other chief priests, maybe. You get chief priests, don't you? Who are probably more chief than ordinary priests, but not as chief as a high priest.
Yeah,
higher than the chief priest.
Yeah, it's just the Complete Jewish Bible says, with whom all the head Kohanim, etc., were assembling.
Yeah, well, I dare say they dragged other people out of bed and got them together. So at this point, they were trying to convict Jesus of blasphemy. Why didn't this work? Because the witnesses, the false witnesses, if you like, couldn't quite get their statements right. And it might not seem to be much different if one says, Jesus said, I will destroy, and another says, I'm able to destroy, and so on. But that was enough, technically, under their law, to disqualify both the testimonies because they didn't quite agree. They might think, usually, you don't expect full agreement from the witnesses in a trial, but in this case, it would be important, particularly if they were trying to quote Jesus's actual words. And there is a difference between saying, I am able to do something and I will do something. Anyway, what you find at this point is that the high priest, who's Caiaphas, gets very annoyed at this point, and he ends up tearing his clothes and so on. And he's actually trying to get a confession out of Jesus himself, which is another aspect of the illegality of it. You can't say if the witnesses haven't agreed, then firstly, you should actually kill the witnesses, because that's what the law says. But secondly, you can't say, oh, well, never mind, we'll still get a conviction by trying to force it out of the guy himself. From that basis, they condemned him as worthy of death, and he gets mistreated yet again, spat at, blindfolded, struck, and so on. All of those things, spitting, striking, and so on, they were all things where the people that did them should have been arrested and at least fined, according to Jewish law. quite significant fines, but it didn't happen. We've got the end of the religious trial at dawn. That's chapter 15. We've moved into the next chapter in Mark, and the whole Sanhedrin gathered together for the final stage of the religious trial, where they had got a guilty verdict, but they've condemned him as worthy of death through this illegal and badly managed process. So now they had to move on to the next stage, which involved the Romans. So the aim now was to secure a death sentence under Roman law. And so now he was led to the praetorium under Pilate. So that's what's going to happen in the opening of Mark 15. And you'll also find it in all the other Gospels as well. So it's now the different charge. It's got to be treason or sedition. So Pilate's interrogation of Jesus centres upon whether he is claiming to be a king, not whether he's claiming to be God or anything like that. But Pilate has to work it all out on the basis of whether Jesus is a threat to Rome. And Pilate is basically not convinced. He doesn't think Jesus is a threat to Rome at this point. So he decides to try and get out of it by sending him on to Herod Antipas. You don't get that in Mark. You'd have to go to Luke chapter 23 for the second stage of the civic trial. Now, again, I dare say Herod Antipas was not too far away from where Pilate was in the Roman area of this. So it's not like a lot of time or a big journey. But if you remember what happens in Luke 23 when Jesus is before Herod, do you remember what Jesus says at that point when he's in front of Herod Antipas? One of my trick questions. Oh, I think we've got someone. Or
yes, you say nothing.
He said nothing, absolutely nothing. He had such contempt for Herod, because all Herod wanted to do was see him perform a sign of some kind. Okay, this is the Herod Antipas, that earlier in the Gospels we learned had wanted to kill Jesus, and some Pharisees came to Jesus and said, Herod wants to kill you, you better run away. And at that point Jesus said, I'm not going anywhere, and called Herod a fox, and basically said, I'm going to carry on. So when eventually they meet, and Herod is effectively insulting him by saying, do me a miracle, Jesus just ignores him, really. except in return, he gets a lot more ridicule and mocking. And so eventually you get the third stage of the second part, which means it's the final component of the six, where he has to come back before Pilate a second time. And Pilate, still convinced that he's innocent, argues for his release. But of course, the Jews won't allow that, basically saying to Pilate, if you let him go, Caesar won't be happy, you'll be seen as weak and so on. So Pilate gives in, washes his hands and so on. And at that point, we know what goes on from there. There's somebody else that in another gospel that declares Jesus to be innocent, as well as Pilate. Do you remember who that is?
Mrs. Pilate.
Yes, that's the only name I've got for her as well. She has a strange dream, doesn't she? I think it's in Matthew's gospel that she comes along and probably that doesn't help Pilate, because he thinks, oh, even more so, I better try and release him. But it didn't happen. So, yeah, those of you that know about the illegality of this, I've hinted at one or two of them, but some people have counted up about 20 different things that should not have happened. And that includes, from the very beginning, the arrest, because the witnesses should have been there at the time of arrest to make the charge then. So you can't just go and arrest someone and then drag them off. They tried to find the witnesses after they had arrested him. And then, as I said, if the testimony wasn't accepted, the witnesses themselves should have been condemned. And there was the lateness of the hour. A trial for life, in other words, a capital offence, if you like, wasn't allowed after dark, but they justified it on the grounds of political necessity and so on. But also through all of this, you get the abuse in which Jesus was slapped. he was mocked, blindfolded, beaten, told to prophesy, repeatedly spat upon, and all these other indignities, and then eventually, of course, flogged. And after that, he was mocked some more by the soldiers, who continued the abuse with the crown of thorns, the robe put the robe on him, striking him on the head and spitting yet again, dressing him up as a king and playing one of their games. And point behind all this is that although God had planned, if you like, that Jesus would die and suffer, and that was going to be bad enough, this was extra human cruelty, and God wasn't in this. This was not part of what God intended for our Passover lamb. But this is an illustration of why Jesus had to die, because this is how the sinful nature of men work themselves out, all the time trying to do other people down and so on. So we've sort of, I suppose, we've now reached, in our Mark account, we're sort of halfway through chapter 15, we've reached the actual crucifixion, being taken out to the place of the skull. And as always, I think in all the Gospels, the crucifixion account is kept fairly simple, fairly sort of just very precise, without a lot of detail, without a lot of unnecessary things that happened. And in the various gospel accounts, you get the things that Jesus actually said. In total, do you remember how many words from the cross there are from Jesus? If you put it all together across the seven, just giving it away. I meant to say across the four gospels, but actually there were seven words from the cross.
Seven?
Yeah, that's right. I think so.
Now, could I ask how many of folk have heard of the Fountain of Tears?
Oh no.
Yeah. Okay. I'll try and get a link and send it to you, Paul. It's an art thing. It's a sculpture thing, and it's very powerful.
Of the seven last words.
The seven last words are relating to the Holocaust. So.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we'll leave it at that.
There's a piece of music. I think it's by Haydn called the Seven Last Words. And so on, because I was really going to ask you, can anyone name me all seven and in the right order? Because I can never quite do that. But let's see collectively how many we can sort out. Anyone you can think of, and obviously you might have got one of the Gospels open in front of you to get us going. The seven things that Jesus said on the cross, what can we remember? Who's going to go first? Someone can tell me one, surely.
Yeah, the beginning of Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
Which was a hint to them to read the whole, it's the whole psalm, not just those words.
Yeah, I think that's right. So what you're really saying there is, as well as it being a sort of cry of despair, it was actually almost teaching them something at the same time, yeah.
Yeah, because okay. I used to worry about that, thinking, well, if Jesus thought he'd been abandoned, but he repeated time and again that he and the Father were always together.
Yeah, but this would be the one time on the cross where that fellowship was broken.
If you read the whole psalm, it shows, no, he hadn't abandoned him.
Clearly. Well, okay. Okay, that's good.
It was the Hebraic teaching method. And he wouldn't have had the breath or the energy to have told them the whole thing.
But... Well, indeed. In fact, at times it's a wonder how he managed to even get any of these short statements out. So that's an exercise for you, Ode Reister, to read the whole of that psalm, Psalm 22. It is very profound and very prophetic in that.
Mm.
Any other of these seven words that you can remember or you've just seen in the text and want to pretend you've remembered?
He handed over his mother to
John. Yeah, to John and Mary, you know, sorting that one out. Okay. Someone else said one?
Finished.
Yeah, the last one, of course, it is finished, as in I've done it, or completed.
Into your hands I commit my spirit.
Yeah.
My thirst.
The one before that, yeah.
He spoke to the other people crucified with him.
Yes.
This day you'll be with me in paradise.
Okay, yes, obviously he spoke to the thief, yeah. We're doing
the word finished. Word finished is the last word of Psalm 22.
Yes, it is. Yes. It's not usually translated as finished. I think it's usually translated as something else, but you're right. It's exactly the same word and would be used. You probably heard what that word is and what it means when it's used in Greek. It means paid.
Paid in full.
Paid in full. Stamped on your invoice to say that it's all done.
Completed.
Completed in that sense. Yes.
About forgiveness.
Father, forgive them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's another one which I can see here in Mark, I think. Or perhaps not. No, it's just. But he cried at one point, I thirst, didn't he? So I think maybe we've got them all between us. But yeah. then it says he breathed his last, or he gave up his spirit, or he committed it back to the Father. You'll have to listen to some of my talks to see what I sort of say actually happened then, unless it comes up in the rest of what we're going to do. But at that point, his life on earth was finished. He'd done everything he needed to do. You get other details in this gospel account here in Mark 15 and one or two other gospels. This darkness for 3 hours, which assumed that something unusual was happening physically and so on. And you get the curtain of the temple torn in two from top to bottom, suggesting that it was God that was doing it. Being ripped from the top downwards. God was actually doing this. And you get the famous centurion saying, surely this man was the Son of God. And if you've ever seen the film of John Wayne acting this role, you'll hear it in a slow American drawl. I'm not going to attempt it, but that was his one line, I think, in the whole film. Surely this man was the Son of God. So then we get to the bit where the body is taken down for burial. And you get Joseph of Arimathea coming into play here, asking for the body and placing it in a tomb cut out of rock. And then he rolled the stone in front of it and so on. You get so many more details in the gospel. This is one of the things which, you know, if we're spending ages and ages on this, you would look at all the gospel accounts, you try and harmonize them, because people say, oh, it doesn't quite match. But allowing for the slight discrepancies you inevitably get in this sort of thing, it does provide a complete scenario where everything fits in somewhere. It's just that you tend to get these four snapshots of it, rather than one continuous account. Now, let me, as we move on to the last chapter, and obviously the good bit, and we'll look at this problem in a minute of why, or the fact that the last chapter seems to have been chopped in two and one bit sort of gone missing and so on. So we've got a few verses, and then you're told that some manuscripts don't have the rest and so on. Some people make a sort of comment that Jesus' physical life began with a Joseph and a Mary, and it ends with a Joseph and a Mary, a Joseph of Arimathea wrapping his body up, and Mary Magdalene, and another Mary, mother of James, and probably another Mary as well, all involved in the spices and so on. So Joseph and Mary, from womb to tomb, as it's sometimes called anyway. you get a very brief version of what's going on here. But I'll focus on the fact that when the Sabbath was over. Now, it's worth looking at Matthew chapter 28 and verse 1. In fact, if you look at the first verse of all the passages where this resurrection is mentioned, you'll see that various sort of time things are mentioned, such that it's either very early in the morning or it's just getting light and that sort of thing. But we talk about the Sabbath being over. And Matthew chapter 28 and verse 1, which I've got somewhere, I was going to explain. Anyone want to read out what they've got for Matthew 28 and verse 1? Because we might have some interesting translations.
Now, after the Sabbath, at the first day in italics, of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and so on.
Yeah, it's a bit more of a...
I've got, and after Sabbaths, plural.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, is that the one you man or?
Yeah, it denotes the weekly Sabbath and a feast day, the first day of unleavened bread.
Yes. It's very, very rare for that word to be translated in the plural, although it is. It is the plural in the Greek, but no other English translation has sort of dared put the S on the end. But as you just explained, this makes a lot of sense if there were two consecutive Sabbaths, which of course there could have been, because there's the weekly Sabbath. I mean, we'll have to talk in our own terms. We have to use words like Friday and Saturday, even though it doesn't make a lot of sense. But there's that one. And the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread was also a Sabbath, as indeed was the seventh day of it. So there are, I think, seven in total extra Sabbaths, annual ones that go with High Holy Days. So it's quite possible, and indeed it makes actually a lot of sense for various other reasons, that actually we've just had two Sabbaths, what we would call a Friday and a Saturday together, and that would be why Jesus would have been crucified on the Thursday, which makes a lot more sense for all sorts of reasons. That basically our traditional Easter weekend is what suits us best, and it suits us best to have the Friday off and then have a long weekend rather than celebrate something on a Thursday, go back to work for the day and then have a weekend and so on. and also I think one of the reasons why the crucifixion was celebrated by the early church once they decided to celebrate Easter separate from the Jewish feasts is they just didn't understand there would be another Sabbath. So for them, it had to be Saturday, and therefore it had to be the Friday for the cross. But it works a lot better if you've got everything going from the Palm Sunday, the 10th of Nisan, which we might have mentioned before, I think we did, was the setting apart of the Lamb. And the examination of the Lamb, we looked at that, kept for a certain number of days, and then you get to the 14th of Nisan. I think we worked it out last time that meant it was the Thursday. And now you've got two consecutive Sabbaths before eventually you get to this strange phase, which it's an awkward phase in Greek, but it seems to represent something in Hebrew. I'm not going to be able to pronounce this very well. I might get this completely wrong. Tell me if you've heard of this. The Motsai-i. No, is it the Motsai-i? Shabbat. That's a strange Hebrew word with lots of vowels at the end that I'm not quite getting right. But the Motsai-i Shabbat, which is the going out of the Sabbath. It was a sort of typical Hebrew phrase for the going out of the Sabbath. Now, I think, a bit from memory here, that they almost sort of personalized the Sabbath, didn't they, in the end, almost idolized it, some of them. And so I think they welcomed the Sabbath in, and then he almost said goodbye to it when it was over. Yeah. Anyone else heard that sort of thing?
Yeah.
We've got a couple of people there, I think. Elizabeth put the hand up, and Alison's ready as well. So come in, one of you.
I do. I go to a Messianic fellowship where I live. And at the end of the Sabbath, we have a special sort of ceremony with the spices, where you smell the spices and you say some Hebrew and you light a candle and stuff like that. So
there's a little ceremony to show it's actually ended, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right.
It's called Haftalah.
That's it, yeah.
Okay.
And it's a plaited candle with three plaits.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some wine as well.
Yeah, there's some wine. Yeah. It's all in little cups.
But also to look forward to the next Shabbat.
Yeah.
Right.
Kind of mourn you mourn the fact that the Shabbat is finished.
Right. Okay.
And I think that's when the early believers, the followers of the way, before they were ever Christians, used to meet. So the idea of meeting on a Sunday was actually Saturday evening.
Yeah.
Because they did Shabbat. And then they were free, but then they would do Haftalah and then would sing their Jesus songs and celebrate. And so the Catholics, actually, with their Mass on Saturday evening, actually are the only ones who do it right.
Yeah, and the Greek Orthodox and other Orthodox churches do all sorts of things.
They do as well, yeah.
Yeah, celebrating. They almost celebrate the resurrection twice, I think. Which is sort of hedging your bets a little bit, but Rose or John,
I just wanted to say about the Havdalah, the cup of wine is to be filled to overflowing, and the plaited candle is to be put out dumping it into the wine so that it overflows, so that the joy of Shabbat is coming to an end as the candle goes out. It's a very nice ceremony.
Yeah.
So my point is, I think probably in Matthew's account, there's a bit of a typical with Matthew, a Hebraic sort of background to it, which accounts for the fact that it's a bit more convoluted when you try and read it, as we might in full, as after the Sabbaths in the dawning towards the first day of the week, which is their sort of convoluted way of saying, I think, that it's sometime during the night of what we call Saturday to Sunday. Because obviously the Sabbath has finished on the Saturday at 6 p.m. And then you get this period of time before the Sunday dawns. Now, I can only assume, because I'm trying to think this through, whenever the other Gospels talk about very early, they must still be referring to it as very early within the daylight, the daytime of it, because very early on the day would obviously be at 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, because that's the first bit of the day. But I think that they still talk about very early on the first day of the week would mean very early in terms of getting up and daylight time, so that otherwise you've actually got strange things happening, like in one of John's Gospel passages, you'd have something happening before Mary Magdalene saw Jesus in the garden. Mm-hmm. So I think when they talk about the evening of the first day of the week, that would... if you're not careful, it's in our terms, it's Sunday evening, but that's almost the next day of the week for them. So you get all sorts of things tangled up about it, if you're not careful, because sometimes John in particular likes to use the Roman version still, where sometimes in the other synoptic gospels, they are using the Jewish time references. but just before you let other people in, just to clarify that in the end, all the gospels are suggesting that by the time you get to dawn, daylight, sunrise, or whatever, on what we would call the Sunday, then Jesus had been raised from the dead. Therefore, during that period of the going out of the Sabbath, but obviously we don't know which particular moment, because it doesn't matter, and we don't need to, and so on. Right, so we've got two people, John, Rose, and then Malcolm.
This was explained to us by a Jewish believer, that as at the beginning of the Sabbath, which would have been as the sun was going down at the at that second Sabbath, so that was what we would call a Saturday night or whatever, it was sunset. And Pesach always takes place at a full moon. So if you're in a garden in a full moon and you're standing under a tree, it's very, very dark under the tree and very bright when you're not under the tree, which would explain why Mary couldn't have seen him, because if he was standing under a tree, she would have seen his feet or realized the person was standing there. But it would be so dark on a full moon night.
But by this time when Jesus appears, which is not the same as his actual resurrection, but when he appears to Mary, the sun has already come up, surely.
No, I don't believe so.
But
no,
what,
I believe isn't that
isn't that what it says?
It's at the beginning of the day, sunset.
So
we were explained that the Greek would mean as the day was rolling on, which means after the sun went down of the day before. So as it's getting darker and darker, because the day starts at sunset.
Okay, so are you telling me that Mary went to the tomb, we'll have to use our terms for this, on the Saturday evening?
Yes.
Correct.
As the sun went down, as the Sabbath ended.
Okay, so early on the first day of the week while it was still dark, that early must refer to, shall we say,
night,
just after 6 o'clock.
Yes, getting dark.
Okay.
But you got the moon.
Well, yes. But you see, equally, the other idea that this is using the sort of the Roman way of doing it, which is what John usually does, early on the first day of the week while it was still dark would be just before sunrise. But let me finish this, because even if that is right, so that the opening of John 20, Mary for some reason is there at shall we say 6 p.m. on the Saturday, that's not the moment when she actually sees Jesus, because that says she goes running off to the other apostles and then they come running over. Okay, and they all eventually come alone and have a look in, and then it says later on she was standing outside the tomb, and that's when she meets him. But you'll still be saying that that would be before, should we say before bedtime that day?
Yes, before bedtime, after the sun went down, before bedtime.
Yeah.
Okay. I
mean, that would be the inference. We don't have to be dogmatic about it, but nonetheless, it would appear that would be the time frame. Because they want to go at the first opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. Would there be any shops open to get the spices at that time? I don't know.
Maybe they already got
them at home. Yeah, okay. But you still have to try and match that in with the other gospel accounts, where, going back to Mark, for instance, when the Sabbath was over, Mark 16:1, they brought spices to anoint his body very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way. So if what you've said is just right from John, then Mark is completely different, isn't it? You'd have to accept that it contradicts it, because they've got sunrise. And on the other one as well, towards the dawning of the first day, would also be relating to when the sun has got up. So it is confusing. And maybe John is using still one time measure like the Roman, and the others are using either the Jewish or a mixture of it and so on. So although I hear what you're saying about the way this Jew has explained it to you, I'm not sure that it computes with all the different bits and pieces. But certainly I've always thought, why didn't they go on the Saturday evening and what the earliest possible time that they could? Anyway, let's go to other people, and then we'll see if we've got any more on this. Malcolm and then Alison.
Yeah, Matthew 28, verse 1 in the Complete Jewish Bible says, after Shabbat, as the next day was dawning.
Yeah, it will use the word dawn as well. Yeah. So
the Sabbath, the day after the Sabbath, Shabbat, was the Feast of First Fruits.
Yeah, exactly. So again, you would want it to match up with the right date of Nisan, if you like. But then, of course, the day still starts in the evening anyway. But I think if it says the first day of the week as it was dawning or as it was getting light, then obviously, although the day has been 12 hours old, if you like, that still is effectively the day beginning for most people's activities from that. But anyway, Alison?
Actually, I think trading happens in the evening on Saturday evening. It does in Israel. Yeah. England, particularly in the north, the Jewish traders prefer the winter to the summer because in the summer, the Shabbat, because it's 25 hours, Shabbat, just to make absolutely sure we haven't got it wrong, they're finished so late, you can't get their shops open again and their restaurants, whereas in the winter you can.
Oh, I see.
This country, because they can get their trading going again.
Yeah.
On Saturday evening. So it's more like if you're in Spain or somewhere like that, everything just kicks off again on Saturday evening.
Okay, yeah, well, they stay up half the night anyway and so on. You just always got to be a little bit careful, and I'm not commenting on this particular case, but saying that's what happens in Israel today and assuming it was like that 2,000 years ago. You know, I'm not saying whether there was a spiral top or not.
I agree with that, but I think the whole concept of day and night is different to what we assume. Because the day begins, so, evenings.
Yeah, the day begins according to the date or the transfer from one day to the next. But still, for most people, your day is going to begin when the sun gets up and you get up and your activities. The day can refer to your time of activity, your period of daylight, whichever way round you put your period of light and darkness. And it might be that in some Gospels it means one way and some another and so on. But there's all these little, what you might call minor discrepancies, which I don't think necessarily contradict the whole thing. So that's why this is one of the most complicated of the gospel pieces to sort of harmonize and that. I've got two more. So John and Rose and then Elizabeth.
Yeah, dawning as in starting to arrive rather than with sunlight. So... the use of the word dawning.
So I don't quite get what you mean there. Starting
of the new day. The new day is dawning.
Oh, I see what you mean. So you could still say...
It's not necessarily associated with sunlight.
So you could say the word dawn refers to 6 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
Or 7 or 8.
Or whatever time it is.
Yeah. But the question, as always, is have the translators turned it into English words to help us?
Hey, ho.
I think they have.
Tried to understand what's going on. So, and as I say, I know the Orthodox Church, well, I don't quite understand it all, but they do something at midnight on Saturday, I think. And then again on the next day or something, just to catch everything there. Elizabeth.
It's just about Jesus being 3 days and 3 nights in the tomb. And obviously, if it was the traditional Friday, it wouldn't have worked if he rose on the...
No, it doesn't. I didn't mean to interrupt. Carry on if you're finishing.
No, just can you clarify that it's definitely 3 days and 3 nights if it's the Thursday?
Okay, I've done a whole talk. In fact, it covers part of two talks that if they're not on the website now, they will be by Monday.
Okay.
Because I will briefly explain it. Mm-hmm. If you go from Thursday to Sunday, you end up with 4 days and 3 nights, unless he was raised in the darkness rather than the dawning. In other words, you don't actually get the fourth day because he rose from the dead, as we've probably been saying, sometime after sunset on the Saturday, to use our terms and so on. Then it does add up. So there's that for a start. The second thing is that when Jesus uses that phrase, he is not referring to his body in the tomb.
Oh.
He doesn't say that. Look carefully at the words that he uses and tries to understand it. Now, it's roughly comparable with the time in the tomb, but he's never referring to his body and he's not referring to his tomb. Okay.
Oh, that's interesting.
Completely different.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the 3 days and three nights, of course, go back to Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
And the context, and it's only in Matthew's gospel. So when you find the equivalent in Luke, there is no reference at all to 3 days and three nights. It's just a sign of Jonah.
Mm.
Okay. So that's the only thing. And in Jonah's case, there's no reference to what the 3 days and three nights means there anyway.
Okay.
So what I examine is that, yes, although I want 3 days and three nights to sort of match, not as a 72-hour period, but certainly it fits in with the, and there's other good reasons for it being Thursday through to Sunday, where you take the first bit of the Thursday, the last bit of daylight, then you've got a night, then you've got a day, then you've got a night, then I'm going to get this counting wrong in a minute, then you've got a day and a final night, but you don't get the fourth day. Right. So the point about the people get round the Friday to Sunday one by saying that a tiny bit of a day is a day and a night. So if you've got 3 hours on the Friday, that's the equivalent of the day and the night, 24 hours. And then you've got a whole day and a tiny bit of the Sunday, and that's your other day and night. And somehow you can make that up to 3 days and three nights. Actually, you can't. You've made it to 3 days and nights, which is not quite the same thing. But anyway, so it doesn't work for Friday onwards if you're looking for a time significance of 3 days and three nights.
Yeah.
Okay. But I would question, as I've just done, that when Jesus is using that phrase, he wants people to think of Jonah, because his point of saying that to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law anyway was that it's about a wicked and rebellious generation who will not repent at Jesus's message, which was the case of Nineveh.
Mm.
So what happened to Nineveh? They were sent the sign of Jonah, and eventually Nineveh repented. So the essence of that comparison isn't even really a time one. It's a one of an effect of a miraculous reappearance causing mass repentance in a wicked city.
Mm-hmm.
And what Jesus is saying to the people that say to him, show us a sign. And he says, this wicked and adulterous generation will not have this sign. Instead, you can have the sign of Jonah. Can I say that? Sign of Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually pointing to the fact that when he has come back from the dead, at some point there will be a massive coming to faith and repentance, which you could say was Pentecost onwards. But he would have to go away and come back again in order for that sign of Jonah to be fulfilled in his own life. Now, I think it does coincide with 3 days and three nights from the Thursday through to the pre-dawn Sunday, if you like. So I'm happy that in the end we've got a match-up, which is really nice. But Jesus is referring in that phrase not to his body. Do you remember what the exact words are that go with this phrase, 3 days and three nights? Do you remember actually what he said? Because that's the trouble. We get these little phrases out of context and we don't actually understand exactly what he said.
Hmm.
I'll probably leave you to investigate that and check it out, because we've got other people wanting to say something. I'll come back if I've got time, but I'll leave you to ponder over that. Malcolm first.
If I may make mention of another speaker, Jacob Prash, he counts the darkness in the afternoon after Jesus died as a night, which would then allow the Friday crucifixion to be three nights.
Okay. Well, how interesting. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I actually personally asked him, you know, what if it, and he said it was a Friday, he thought,
But in order to make that, I mean, if you think it's just an idiom anyway, you're not trying to count hours. The problem with the Friday is that you've almost got to have Jesus coming in on Palm Monday, which you might have done, because you've got to have the 10th of Nisan matching up with the 14th of Nisan, so you've got to count backwards from that point of view. Or you also get a spare day of the week when nothing happens. So it's, I don't know, I'm not saying it's definitely sorted. It's just people try and work around all sorts of things. We've got a comment from, is it John coming in there? John?
Yes, David Searle has written a book on the whole subject. And I, although I haven't read it, I've heard that it's extremely good. And so if you get a hold of that book, I advise you to do so. And then you can have it in your hands and read it, have it, you know, word for word. But it's extensively researched, as you know, David Searle does that. And that's what I could recommend to you. And so, because there seems to be a lot of muddling. There seems to be a lot of muddling going on. We're listening to this talk at the moment. So that's my contribution. I haven't read it myself, Mike. People are very, very involved, but it does explain everything.
Yes, I've got that book and I have read it, and it is very involved. It's by David Searle and Peter Sammons, actually.
That's it, yeah.
And they are making out, I think, a very good case for it being the Thursday, based upon all sorts of different things. And if you know the way that, David writes and the way that Peter does things, there's lots of diagrams to help you and lots of other interesting things on that. But for me, what Jesus is saying in that phrase, although it has this time element and it does link to Jonah as a sort of hint or comparison and so on, Jesus isn't actually talking about his body at all in the tomb. But it still matches up with 3 days and three nights. But I'm going to stop there. And we haven't yet talked about the very ending of Mark 16. And I can't really say much about it, except that some manuscripts stop with the women being afraid and others add something which we believe is right from other sources, that Jesus appears to them. Otherwise, you know, you haven't got much of a resurrection in Matthew's gospel if you do leave off at the end of verse 8. So I think somehow the remaining ending must be genuine. Somehow a bit got lost somewhere. Malcolm.
Dr. Grady McMurtry, of whom you have probably heard.
Say again, sorry.
Dr. Grady McMurtry.
No, I haven't.
He's on Revelation TV.
Ah.
And has been for many years. He says that there was a special Shabbat in front of the normal Shabbat. I can't remember what he called it, but that was his story.
Yeah, that's what we've already said, I think, that there were two consecutive Shabbats. It'd be the first day of unleavened bread.
Mm.
Okay, because after Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread begins straight away. So the next day is a Shabbat. And then you can still have your weekly Shabbat. You eventually have another one, actually, at the end of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So the other problem is we don't know exactly which year we're talking about, do we? There's lots of different ideas as to which year it is, whether it's 27, 30, 31, 33, and so on. Just like we don't know the exact year of Jesus' birth, there's lots of things like that, but doesn't help us to pinpoint things that accurately. But what's the most important thing after all this? Now is Christ risen. Okay, exactly how, exactly when, exactly who saw what, where, when, and how, at which point, and so on. What we definitely know is that Jesus appeared in a new body, first to Mary, to the others, and to several other people. And that's what changed the world. And the gospel writers have given us as much information as they could understand or wanted to pass on to us, so that we can accept it by faith without having a complete running commentary on every single moment of every single day, every single thing that happened. Malcolm again.
He did have these scars from the nails in his body. So, you know, the new body must have been a replica of the original one.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting extra point. He was able to show that at times, whether they were hidden at other times, because otherwise people would have noticed it beforehand, whether he could somehow manifest them again, and in which case, what about the feet? Why didn't people notice that he got big nail holes in his feet? So there's all sorts of extra mysteries about the nature of the new body, which is all very interesting and important, because, as we said, this is first boots. If Jesus is our first boots, then what we can learn about his resurrection applies to our resurrection as well. So we're looking forward also to getting a new body like unto his. And I take the point that it will have some characteristics, at least, of what we've been like in this world. It will bear the sort of distinctiveness of us as individual people now. We don't all come back as all looking exactly the same, or all being sort of like mannequins or something, instead of individual people. But I think it's important that we not only uphold the resurrection, obviously, as a biblical truth and as central to our faith, but this is the hope for people, to try and make them realize that Christianity isn't all a sort of pie in the sky when you die sort of thing. You know, go and get your harp and your halo and enjoy the clouds for eternity. There's something much more to look forward to, because Jesus' resurrection indicates ours as well. So, and we'll end on that hopefully joyous hallelujah note. Let's switch the recording off at this point. Thank you.